Thank you very much, Sarah, for these very kind words. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Of course, this is an institution of some name and fame, and I'm happy to be part of this for this one Friday afternoon. Now, let me take 1 minute to get us all on the same factual level. So we're talking about a case on the events immediately following 11th of July 1995. We have a UN-led peacekeeping force in Srebrenica, UNPROFOR. And Dutchbat was a Dutch contingent part of UNPROFOR and charged with the mandate to protect the safe area of Srebrenica. On 11th of July, Mladic and his men attacked Srebrenica. Refugees from Srebrenica flew into the compound of Dutchbat. And from then on, the story is well known. The men were separated from the women and the children, and about 7,000 men were killed. Now, this led to a flux of legal and political processes, of course, in the ISTY, with Mladic and Karadzic, but in particular also in the Netherlands. We have had a series of political inquiries into the responsibility or for the failure to protect, but that's a court issue, by Dutchbat. The Dutch Prime Minister resigned over this, so this really was cut very deep in the political landscape in the Netherlands. But the relatives of the victims were not content with that political aftermath and actually sought justice in the courts. In part, for the main part, formal recognition of wrongdoing, perhaps, but that's still open, also compensation. Now, for proper understanding, there are two separate cases still in the courts of the Netherlands. There's one case, which is the more difficult one, brought by the so-called mothers of Srebrenica against the state of the Netherlands and against the United Nations for failure to protect. In that case, there has been a Court of Appeals ruling upholding the immunity of the United Nations, and that decision is now appealed to the Supreme Court. The second case, and that's the case on which I will be talking, is the case concerning two individuals only. So the other case is really a case about the entire situation, the entire failure to protect the enclave. There's a case at hand, is a case concerning the events surrounding the death of a very limited number of people. There are two decisions in this case. One is called Mustafic, the other one is Nuhanovic. The decisions are identical. I will only speak about the Nuhanovic case. Nuhanovic was a translator, worked for Dutchbat. He had a pass, UN pass, and he survived. But his father, his brother, and his mother were all killed. Now, I should disclose that I have some personal stakes in this case. I advised the law firm who worked as attorneys for Nuhanovic, and more in particular my wife, I guess it's something that should be disclosed, is the lead attorney for Nuhanovic. And to make it more difficult, even my role as external advisor for the Minister of Foreign Affairs puts me in the other side of the case. So I will try to find a neutral middle way between these competing interests here. Now, before saying anything else on the legal niceties of the case, let me just say that for Nuhanovic, the outcome of this case was a major event of justice after having tried for more than 10 years, 17 years, to find a venue for justice. He has tried to find his way in New York, against the United Nations. The United Nations has always declined any legal responsibility for wrongdoing, even though, of course, Kofi Annan in his report admitted political failures and political responsibility. The lower court in the Netherlands declined to rule in favor of Milanovic, finding that the acts in question could only be attributed to the UN. So he was caught in a situation where the Dutch court said this is a UN question, and the UN declined responsibility. And then if you sue the UN in the Netherlands, the Court of Appeals finds that there's immunity of the UN. So, I mean, basically all hope had gone in this case until this somewhat unexpected ruled in favor of Milanovic. So it was a matter of some political courage of the court in The Hague to take this rather unexpected at the time step. Now, there's one last preliminary point to make, and this is a rather unique factual set of facts. This is not your run-of-the-mill peacekeeping case, as more cases have been brought in different places in the world. At least for two reasons, this case is rather unique, and it also should make us a bit cautious to draw general lessons from it. One is that, as I said, this is not a case about the actual protection or failure to protect a safe haven. I mean, this is a claim in the other case, the Modus Absentia case. In this case, it is not about the failure to protect, it is about the actual eviction of individuals from the compound. So the family of Nahanovic, were actually evicted from the compound because Dutch Bed wanted to evacuate without these three members of the family. So there's, of course, a substantial difference between actual eviction and failure to protect. And the former, of course, is not as common in practice as the latter. The second point that makes the case rather unique, and that is critical for understanding the case and appreciating it, is that the court identified that there was a stage of transition from the normal peacekeeping situation to the situation of evacuation of Dutch Bed. Basically, the activities of Dutch Bed had come to their end, because Srebrenica was overtaken by the Bosnian Serbs. So there was no longer a role to play for Dutch Bed in protecting a safe area that was no longer there. And that transition explains, in large part, why the Netherlands, why The Hague, actually got involved to the extent that it did, in order to prepare the way for the return of Dutch Bed eventually to the Netherlands. And that also is a very distant feature that limits somewhat the scope of the holdings for other situations. Now, the core of my remarks focuses on what Sarah said, the question of sharing, the question of dual attribution of the act in question, so of the eviction of the three family members of Hasan Luhanovic from the compound. Should they be attributed to the UN, to the Netherlands, or to both? Now, the importance of the case is that the court here recognizes that it may well be both. Now, this is a difficult topic. If you review the literature, there are quite a few people, but not very many, who acknowledge the possibility of dual attribution. Condorelli's work, I guess, stands out in a way on this point, on very fundamental grounds, on the grounds that when troops are contributed to the UN, they always remain organs of the state, and therefore always have this double capacity as organ of the state and as being under the control of the UN. And in modern times, Dennebaum, in a very good piece in the Harvard Journal of International Law, and also Sari, have argued for dual attribution. But the issue is not at all clear. Ago, to the extent that he did express himself on the point, seems to exclude the possibility of dual attribution in this type of context. And of course, the European Court of Human Rights in Behrami Sarmanti expressly rejected the possibility of dual attribution. It has been said that the European Court reversed this in Algeda, and there's a good piece by Marko Milanovic that argues as much, but I'm not so sure actually that the court actually did this in Algeda. It simply left open the issue, and it's by no means certain that the European Court of Human Rights will actually accept this type of dual attribution. The IOC, for the matter, in the draft articles on the responsibility of international organizations, did expressly leave open the possibility. In paragraph 4 of the commentary to chapter 2, it is stated that although it may not frequently occur in practice, dual or even multiple attribution of conduct cannot be excluded. And it points to the possibility of attribution to one act, to a state and organization, or for that matter, to multiple organizations. But if you read further in the draft articles, the issue is not so clear at all. If you would come, for instance, to Article 48, which deals with multiple claims, with claims against multiple responsible parties, the IOC lists a number of situations in which this situation may arise, in which there may be multiple responsible entities. It points to Articles 12 to 16 and 58 to 61, but it does not point to the attribution issue under Article 7, and that is what we are dealing with here. Article 7, attribution of troops being put at the disposal of the UN. So the IOC is somewhat ambiguous, and also on that account, this is quite interesting and very welcome judgment that explains how one can actually conceptualize and construe a case of dual attribution. Now, for the before I get to the construction of the court, it's clear that from the perspective of the victims here, from Mihanovic, dual attribution has a major normative appeal, because it opens the possibility of bringing a claim against one or the other, or to both parties involved. And precisely in cases where the procedure for a claim against one of the parties is blocked, as in this case by immunity, dual attribution opens the way of finding relief for the other involved party. So in this type of situations where a troop contributing state and the UN together are in the business of peacekeeping and may take decisions in regards to events on the compound, dual attribution prevents or enhances the possibility of finding an avenue for relief for the victims. But then still the question is, how do you construe this? Now, the crux of the matter, as I said, is in Article 7 of the draft articles on the responsibility of international organizations. But before I get to this, there's one other point that shows how the UN and the Netherlands were together, acting together, and how access in procedure against one may affect the other. In the first instance case, when the court said the act in question, so the eviction of Milanovic, can only be attributed to the UN. The fallback argument of the plaintiffs was that, well, that may well be, but if you cannot have a procedure against the UN, then responsibility would fall back on the troop contributing state. That is, in essence, the construction in Article 61 of the draft articles on responsibility of international organizations. This is the construction based on the Waite and Kennedy case law and the Bosphorus case law of the European Court of Human Rights. If you transfer powers to an organization, the organization acts commits an intentional wrong, and if then there is no recourse against the organization, the responsibility for that act might actually be attributed to the state. The courts in first instance rejected the claim. The argument was again made in appeal, but the court did not need to rule on this because, as I will show later, the court ruled in favor of plaintiffs on other grounds. But in the parallel case, which is now before the Supreme Court against the UN, so this is the case of the Mothers of Srebrenica against the United Nations, the Court of Appeal upheld the immunity of the UN, but expressly ruled on this principle, and it said, we recognize that there may be an exception to the immunity of the UN when there is no recourse against the UN, but it said this is not applicable on the present time because there is a possibility to sue the Netherlands, to find recourse against the Netherlands. Now, that's a bit awkward construction, because that's not really the underlying thought of this article, but it does show the intricate relationship between the UN and the Netherlands, and that if an act against the UN fails, the member states can actually be held responsible for the same act. And because this was the same court that had made this argument has now ruled in favor of Milanovic, and there's a strong suspicion that actually it delivered on that promise. So when it upheld the immunity of the UN, it said this is acceptable because you can sue against the Netherlands. It would have been very odd then for the same court to close the door in the proceedings against the Netherlands. In a way, it had created the expectation that it would be open to this claim. So again, on that ground, you see the very complex interaction between the UN and the Netherlands, and that, in a way, is the mirror image of the construction of dual attribution, to which I will come now. So the crux, then, is in Article 7 of the draft articles on responsibility of international organizations. The standard for attribution. The Court of Appeal in The Hague accepted firmly that this standard, effective control, is to be the decisive standard for attribution. It rejected expressly the standard of ultimate control that was used by the district court. It also expressly rejected the standard used in the Grammy. And that somewhat ambiguously still played a role in the later Al Jeddah case. So the court aligns itself with IOC and chooses for effective control. Now, the remarkable thing is that Article 7 speaks only about effective control as a ground for attribution of the act to the organization, not to the member state. And an important preliminary question on which the court spends only one line is whether this standard actually can work both ways. Because you could make the argument, and that was in a way the line of reasoning in Dahrami and also in Al Jeddah, that okay, if you accept effective or for that matter ultimate or overall control as standard of attribution for the organization, then the only question is, did the organization have effective control or overall control or not? If not, then responsibility remains with the member state. But in that construction, you always first would have to determine the nature of control exercised by the UN. The court here doesn't do that. It doesn't spend one word on the nature of control exercised by the UN, because it argues that this Article 7, or the standard of effective control, is a two-edged sword, and it also should be applied to determine whether or not a troop contributing state has control and whether the act can be attributed to that state. That And actually, people representatives of the government have come on public records to argue that this exactly this point will be one of the lines in cassation if the matter goes on to cassation. Now, I should say that the ILC in the commentary actually fully supports the line taken by the court. The commentary to Article 7 says that it is a criterion for attribution of conduct either to the contributing state or the organization. And later it says the criterion is who has effective control. So either the organization or the member state. So if this would go to cassation, I would assume that the court would lend quite a bit of weight to the commentary by the ILC. It's difficult to see where otherwise they would get their sort of the input for their legal opinion. So this may well stand, this probably should stand in cassation. Now, the key then is, of course, what is effective control? How do you demonstrate that the Netherlands, or the UN for that matter, had effective control? And the problem here is that we are really talking here about not about a positive act, but we're talking about an omission. Because if you again construct this, what happens is that three people on the compound decided to evict the family members of Nahanovic, and no action was taken to prevent that or correct it. So the question is, what does it mean to have effective control over an act of three people who actually did something that was against the orders of both the UN and the Netherlands? And the order coming both from New York and from The Hague was to protect the refugees, unspecified, but there clearly was no order, at least it has not been demonstrated in court, there was no order by either the UN or by The Hague that these people should be evicted. So the question then is, what does it mean to have effective control in regards to an act that actually deviates from the orders from both The Hague and New York? Now, the construction chosen by the court is that effective control means not only a specific instruction in regards to a particular conduct, but also whether, if there's no specific instruction, the UN or the state has the power to prevent the conduct in question. So the question was, who was able to prevent the conduct concerned? So this creates a whole series of assumptions. But assuming then, that seems to be the argument here, assuming that The Hague or New York had knowledge of the unfolding events, who had the power to prevent that conduct from happening? And whoever had that power, and it might well be both, as we will see in a second, whoever had that power would then have effective control, and that act then would have to be attributed to one or two of these entities. And this does, of course, open a very, very wide door, because you could well argue, and it's hard to argue against it actually, that the true contributing country always has the power to prevent that conduct. Because, of course, the true contributing country retains the power to take disciplinary measures in regards of individual soldiers. So if it is the case that the soldiers acted against an order to protect refugees, then clearly the true contributing state always has the power to to control it. But if that is the case, then the question is, where does it stop? Does not always then have the troop contributing state the power to intervene? And does not this, almost by definition, lead to a situation of double attribution? And then we're quite close to the construction by Condorelli, who indeed argued that by definition, acts of peacekeeping forces are always attributable to both the troop contributing state and the United Nations. Now the court, and actually this, precisely this reading of the case has caused quite a bit of concern certainly in the Netherlands, but I believe also outside, with the military. And serious positions have already been heard that in the future we might well have to rethink our willingness to take part again in peacekeeping operations if this type of liability based on an ability to prevent might trigger liability. Of course, it's fact-specific, but one can imagine a series of different scenarios where a state would have the information and would have had the possibility to intervene. If not doing that would lead to liability, one might well rethink the wisdom of sending troops in the first place. Now, the courts seem to be aware of that risk, and it then construes this standard. So effective control defined in terms of the power to prevent. They approach this in a twofold analysis, partly normative and partly, and that's quite critical, factual. So the normative part of the analysis of effective control really is based on the power, the retention of power to take disciplinary measures, as I just said. But the closing of the door part really comes in with the facts. The court says that the facts of the case, and in particular again the stage of transition from a normal peacekeeping operation to a situation of evacuation, these facts explain that the government was actually heavily involved in the day-to-day events. And it is that day-to-day involvement through a series of communications and instructions that might differentiate this case from other cases, and that might just sort of reduce the risk that this ruling might have adverse effects for willingness to send troops in future situations. So in terms of the factual analysis, the court examines a series of instructions from The Hague to the Dutch soldiers on the ground. Let me give you a few examples. Nicolai, this is from the judgment. Nicolai was a commander in UNPROFOR. So he had a blue helmet, and he was there as a UN agent. And during the witness examination in this case, Nicolai had said that he was the authorized negotiator on behalf of the government and UNPROFOR. So he suggested that he would have a double role. He points to the fact that this was indeed a turning point, a stage of transition. Dutchbat had ended, and he acted both for the Netherlands and for the UN in that sense, quote, I kind of had a double role. He also said, normally I did not receive any orders from the Netherlands, but only from the UN. At that this moment, the Netherlands also participated in the decision making. Likewise, Karamans, who has now a sort of dubious claim to fame, because Karamans was the person who actually negotiated with Mladic on the evacuation of the men to the buses, which led to the eventual killings, and there are somewhat awkward televised pictures of Karamans drinking glasses of wine with Mladic to celebrate, in a way, the successful results of these negotiations. Garlemans, and actually they're still in the courts of the Netherlands, there's still a criminal investigation against Garlemans for his individual, possible individual wrongdoing in this case. Garlemans also noted that in the facts of knowledge actually referred to the instructions coming both from New York and from The Hague. So the upshot of this is that there were two lines of the communications. The Netherlands, the capital of the Netherlands, the government of the Netherlands, were actively involved in the monitoring of events. And that is the suggestion created by the court in a quite critical paragraph 518. The facts do not leave room for any other conclusion than that if the Dutch government would have given instruction not to allow Nahanovic to leave the compound, such an instruction would have been executed. So this is the practical manifestation of the power, the ability of the government of the Netherlands to prevent the conduct in question. And this is then the basis of the attribution of the acts to the Netherlands. Now, the open question remains here, of course, because the question still is, would this not always have been the situation? Even if you would not have had these dual commands coming out from The Hague and from New York. Clearly, if that would not have happened, and The Hague would have been aware of the events, I think this conclusion still would stand. If at that point, Minister Voorhoeven, who was the Minister for Defense at the time, would have instructed Nicolai or Garlemans not to evict the persons, the instruction most likely would have been executed. So I'm not sure that the court succeeded entirely in closing the wide door that it earlier opened that might lead, by definition, to double attribution of acts of peacekeeping forces. So on this basis, the court then opens the possibility that indeed the act might be attributed twice. It had said earlier in paragraph 5.9, and if you read the judgments, the key legal holdings are really contained in paragraphs 5.8 and 5.9, and in a way everything else follows from this. The court says that it cannot be ruled out that the application of the effective control criterion results in possibility of attribution to more than one party. Now, because of this, it does not examine at all the possible attribution to the UN. It limits itself to the position of the Netherlands. But it follows, so it would seem, from the construction of effective control in terms of who has the power to prevent, that that criterion in itself indeed could lead to double attribution. Because if it is true that the Netherlands, and I go back to my previous slide, if the Netherlands could have given the instruction not to allow Nuhanovic, it would seem that certainly also the UN line of command, who was very familiar with what happened, could have given that order. And that is that instruction also would have been executed. And I should recall that there was no issue here of conflicting instructions. It was not a case where one party instructed Dutchbat to evict this person and other not. It simply happened and no one intervened. But if this is the standard, then clearly both The Hague and New York could have given that order. And if the failure to do so triggers attribution, then this standard indeed leads to double attribution. Now there's one caveat here, and that is the problem of ultra vires acts. Because if indeed the order was that the refugees should be protected, which I must say was a rather open textured order. It was not really clear how you would apply that in the circumstances at hand. Then the decision of Kamans to evict Nuhanović, or the three members of the Nuhanović family, was an ultra-virus order. Now, Article 8 of the draft articles, which I see, of course, suggests that even an ultra-virus act is attributed to the organization. At the same time, it is also true that the power to take disciplinary measures against the soldiers who acted ultra-virus rested, of course, with the troop contributing state. So if you give that fact, if the power, the normative power of the state to take disciplinary measures as a decisive criterion, as the court seemed to do, and also, as I note, that Tom Dennebaum in his Harvard International Law Journal piece does, Dennebaum actually argues that in case of ultra-virus acts, the acts should be attributed only to the troop contributing state, because it's only that state who has the power to take corrective measures and to prevent further wrongdoing on their side. So, I mean, there's a question here whether the ultra-virus nature of the acts actually would plead against dual attribution in this particular case, on the construction of the article as conducted by the court itself. I think it can be done under the ROC articles, but given the importance that the court attached to disciplinary measures, I'm not sure that for the court that would have worked. Now, if there is dual attribution, I mean, the prime consequence here is that the Netherlands and the UN could be sued. Beyond that, it of course depends on what will claim, what will be awarded in terms of damages. That's rather speculative, but that might lead to a situation where multiple wrongdoing entities might be faced with obligation to pay compensation in regards of one and the same event. But I'll leave that for future future discussion. But finally, briefly, on the substance of the case, after having determined that the acts in question could be attributed to the Netherlands, the court then moves to a discussion of whether the act in question was wrongful. Now, whereas the entire discussion on attribution is based on public interest law proper, the discussion on the wrongfulness is understandably based on domestic law, notably Bosnian law, because under the applicable Dutch conflict of laws, Bosnian law was the applicable law. But international law does play a role. Plaintiffs had invoked both the European Convention on Human Rights and the ICCPR, and also the Genocide Convention, notably the judgment of the ICJ in a genocide case. The application of the European Convention raised, of course, the interesting spectrum of a Oscani-type question whether the European Convention would be applicable at all in Bosnia to acts of peacekeeping forces. The court sort of prevents that discussion by arguing on the one hand that the European Convention is directly applicable in the law of Bosnia and could thus be applied as part of the domestic law of Bosnia. And in a more difficult construction, I would think, argues that the standards are part of customary international law and can be applied without applying the European Convention as such. Finally, the specific situation that the family members of Nuhanović were only evicted at the very end of the stay of Dutch Vatican, just days before Dutchman was actually leaving, prevented a rather difficult question for the courts, namely whether it should have had to balance the effects of keeping them on the compound against the protection and the interests of Dutchman. That is an issue that has played out and will play out in the other proceedings of the Brothers of Srebrenica, because there the argument has been, if you keep 5,000, 10,000 people on the compound, it actually might jeopardize the battalion as such and the prospects for an overall evacuation. Because this concerned only three individuals at the very end of the procedure, the court did not have to go into that area. So where are we with the judgment? Monday actually, over in 3 days from now, the next stage will be here. This, oddly enough, is only an interim judgment. The court still has to take a decision on the one outstanding claim, namely that the right to a fair trial of Nuhanović has been violated by the fact that one judge in the lower courts, who had expressly in interproceedings appeared favorable to the claim of the plaintiffs, that judge was replaced from the bench. There is an article under Article 6 of the European Convention in regard to those events. There will be hearings in the court this Monday, and only afterwards there will be a final decision in this case, and only then the time starts to run for a possible cassation by the states. I would think that cassation will be tried by the states. Many politicians have gone on record as being quite upset by this judgment. The chances that it will be reviewed seem slim. The Court of Cassation cannot review the facts, and this case is extremely much fact-driven. So one point on which cassation might focus itself is on the interpretation and construction of Article 7, and in particular the question whether the effective control standard cuts both ways, both to the organization and to the state. But given the support of the commentary of the IOC on that particular point, I would be extremely surprised if the Supreme Court would dare to overthrow this particular ruling. So I'll leave it at this, and I'm happy to hear any intriguing insights and comments that we might use in the further stages of this procedure. Thank you very much.